From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in New York today for the UN General Assembly, the world's largest diplomatic gathering. The president hosted a meeting this morning with more than 120 other nations to talk about reforming the UN, an organization he's been critical of in the past. And there are some major global challenges for leaders to discuss this week, including a nuclear-armed North Korea and the Iran nuclear deal. Joining us from New York is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's talk about the president's meeting this morning on reforming the UN. What do we know about what was discussed?
Well, not a lot, to be honest. I've been coming up here for many years now, and that was probably the shortest meeting that I've ever seen. Nikki Haley calls it a new day for the UN. The format was certainly new. Countries had to sign a pledge to support the Secretary General's reform agenda just to have a seat in the room. 128 countries did. But the only people who spoke were Haley, President Trump, and Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General, and he seemed very eager to show that he's determined to cut the red tape and make the UN more effective. It's clearly a way of keeping President Trump engaged here.
Trump has been meeting today with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and a big topic there, the Iran nuclear deal. What are we expecting?
Well, you know, the Trump administration has been talking about changing the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump himself has said that, you know, it's the worst deal that he's ever seen negotiated. But so far, he's kept the U.S. side of the bargain with sanctions relief. He's also been trying to step up sanctions not related to the nuclear deal, but on to other nefarious activities, including Iran's support for the Syrian regime and cyber attacks, for instance. So he's likely to make a big push on this at the U.N. But, you know, the other thing to watch here is how the Europeans respond. They're part of this nuclear deal, too, and they want to keep it on track. And they're organizing a meeting later in the week that could include all the signatories, which means not Trump, but perhaps Secretary of State Tillerson will be there along with his Iranian counterpart. And it would be their first face-to-face conversation.
What about North Korea, which continues to ignore the UN Security Council's ban on its missile tests and developing nuclear weapons? The UN Security Council voted unanimously last week for new sanctions. What more can they do? Or are we expecting even more sanctions?
Well, I mean, for now, the Trump administration wants to see the sanctions that were imposed actually implemented. That's going to be the big push from the U.S. side. The other side, the Russians and the Chinese, though, say, you know, there are two sides of this resolution. There's the sanctions, but those sanctions are meant to pressure North Korea back to the negotiating table. And what they want the Trump administration to do is consider their plan, which is entice the North back to talks by suspending U.S. South Korean military exercises. The Trump administration has said that's a non-starter. Tillerson has said he doesn't want to negotiate his way back to the negotiating table, but we're going to have to see how that plays out this week. There's a lot of different players at the table.
In previous years, one of the big topics has been the war in Syria, which has, as we know, caused a massive refugee crisis and has become a home base for ISIS. Is that going to be a big topic this year? Because it does go on.
It does. Secretary Tillerson has already met with his Russian counterpart last night, and we were told that the main topic was Syria. I suspect that's going to be a theme of many of his meetings this week. But the Trump administration seems much more focused on fighting ISIS than resolving the civil war. And that's sort of what we're seeing, at least in the public schedule, that the meetings are going to be on the de-ISIS coalition, as the Trump administration likes to call it.
Just about 30 seconds left here, Michelle, but we know that Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader of Myanmar, is not going to be there. She's come under criticism for what's happening with the Rohingya Muslims who are fleeing. Who else isn't coming?
Vladimir Putin's not coming, though, as I said, the foreign minister is here. And another key player is Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, is not here. But Trump spoke with him by phone, and the White House says that the message that he gave the Chinese leader was the need to enforce those sanctions and keep up the pressure on North Korea.
That's Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent, joining us from the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
St. Louis has seen 4 days of protests now after a white police officer was cleared by a judge in the shooting death of a black man. Today's protests were peaceful. Last night's became violent. Over 80 were arrested. Because of questions about police shootings, some places are calling for more transparency. Washington State's King County, for example, calls for public inquests whenever an interaction with police results in a death. The format is controversial. Some say it promotes transparency, even healing. Others call it a farce. So what is it? Amy Radel from KUOW in Seattle has our story.
Up to 18 states still hold public inquests. Others convene grand juries in private. King County, which includes Seattle, is the only county in Washington state that calls an inquest whenever someone is killed by police. County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg says inquests provide a window to the public.
It's been a practice here which I think has served us well in putting the full facts of a case before the public and before an inquest jury.
But Satterberg admits inquests can be bewildering. They look like trials with judge, jury, and cross-examination, but they carry no penalties. On the other hand, the testimony can be used later on in criminal or civil cases. In other states, inquest jurors vote on whether the killing was justified or unlawful. King County inquests don't go that far. Jurors only consider questions like, did the person obey police commands, and did the officer feel threatened? It's a process that leaves some family members embittered.
It was a joke to me. I mean, and this is going from having full faith in the process and the justice system. It was a joke.
That's Michael Murphy, the father of a college student who was shot by Seattle police in 2009. Police say his son, Miles, refused commands to drop a rifle he was firing in the air during a New Year's Eve celebration. The rifle turned out to contain blanks. An inquest was held several months later. Michael and his wife, Diane, were hoping for answers.
I was actually worried that I didn't want to come out against the police before the inquest.
We wanted to be fair.
We were being fair. You know, we weren't going to, we just wanted to wait and see. Now, looking back, sometimes I really regret that.
Michael says seeing police officers take the stand was the biggest letdown.
Then our attorneys get a chance to ask questions.
Right.
All of a sudden, oh, I can't recall.
No.
I can't recall.
That's right.
I can't recall. Every question that was asked by our attorneys, they either muttered very short answers or most of them were, I don't recall. I don't recall.
Diane says the hearings seem designed to put her son in the worst possible light, with no way to challenge or advocate for him. Prosecutor Dan Satterberg says that's not the purpose of the inquest.
It's not a memorial service, and it's not a chance for, you know, to talk about the better aspects of the person who's been killed. It's just really about the events that led up to the decision of the police officer to use deadly force.
The testimony presented in the inquest and the jury's answers then go to the prosecutor to determine whether criminal charges are warranted against the officer. But families often feel like their most urgent questions were ignored. Pierce Murphy is the former head of misconduct investigations for the Seattle Police Department.
Why did this happen in the first place? What could have happened to prevent it? Those are really, really important questions.
And Murphy says there's currently no way for the public to ask them. Some activists say inquests should delve into them. Others say the county should get rid of inquests altogether and just focus on criminal investigations against officers who use excessive force. Seattle attorney Derek Isaacson has represented police officers at inquests.
Anytime that an officer has had to use force that's resulted in someone's death, it's very difficult for that officer.
At the inquest, Isaacson says officers have to revisit that incident, knowing that they could still face discipline, criminal charges, and civil lawsuits.
They're essentially having to relive that in open court, in front of the public, in front of a jury, and they have to provide them with that information.
But Isaacson says the neutral atmosphere can allow people to get at the truth and for some healing to take place.
If you start to change it and you start to make it more confrontational, then you might as well eliminate it.
Isaacson says inquests harken back to times when it was difficult to get information around a police shooting. These days, he says, members of the public can seek records through public disclosure and could go straight to a civil lawsuit. and inquest participants agree they're more useful when the public knows what to expect. Last spring, attorney Bree Blackhorse represented the family of Renee Davis, a Native American woman shot by King County Sheriff's deputies in 2016. At the inquest, Blackhorse wanted to ask the officers about their crisis intervention training and de-escalation techniques, but the judge was up front.
The court told the family this isn't going to be a satisfactory process. The questions that the family really wants answered are more appropriate for a civil suit.
Davis's family used the inquest as an opportunity to question officers under oath, and Blackhorse says she'll use that testimony in their upcoming lawsuit. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Radel in Seattle.
On April 15, 2013, Jeff Bowman, like thousands of others, pushed his way to the finish line of the Boston Marathon to finally show up for his on-again, off-again girlfriend, Erin, who was running the race. And as you watch events unfold in the new film about Jeff, it's impossible not to know what's coming. Three people around Jeff would die that day. He would have, if not for a guy in a cowboy hat named Carlos. You've seen the picture, Jeff pushed in a wheelchair by Carlos Arredondo. Over a dozen lost legs that day. Jeff lost both. His hospital bed description of one of the bombers helped find both of them. He became a symbol of Boston Strong. We've talked here with Jeff about his struggles with that fame he didn't ask for, with the loss of his legs. But in the new movie Stronger, based on Jeff's memoir, we see it was actually a lot harder than the sunny side up Jeff ever let on. Jeff Bowman joins us along with Jake Gyllenhaal, who plays him in the film. And Jeff, start with you. It's unflinching. You live in your mom's walk-up with no legs. Your mom is often alcohol-soaked. Your whole rambunctious family clearly adores you, but can smother you. How hard was that to see?
Yeah, it brings back a lot of memories. You know, she's still very smothering. She's very loving. I can't get rid of her.
Well, she drinks a lot. The family drinks a lot.
You don't drink anymore.
No, I don't. So I haven't drank in 15 months. So.
Well, it's funny. I was going to say, when you'd written and alluded to some of your loving family's issues, even then it felt like you were straddling two worlds. You know, your fabulous, wonderful boss, Kevin, at Costco.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Who was part of your rescue team. You know, he's gay, and your family wasn't sure. We see this in the film, how they feel about that. It feels like you were almost taking that step that young adults do away from your family, even before the bombing.
Yeah, I think we fight our families sometimes.
Right, but you're forced, when you lose two limbs, to live upstairs in a bedroom, eventually with your girlfriend, Erin, who's crossing with your mom.
Yeah.
This was tough.
Yeah, it was funny to watch the movie with them both. Because after they were like, we didn't do that, they're both crying and like hugging each other. And I'm like, yeah, you did. And I'm like, do you guys not remember this? And,
well, Jake Gyllenhaal, what was it that you wanted to bring out about Jeff? You got to know each other. I can see, as we've been getting ready to talk, you've obviously become friends. What was it you wanted to bring out about Jeff?
What I was interested in was being able to portray the pain that Jeff went through as best as we could, which inevitably led to, I think, the joy and the love between Jeff and Erin and his family. And so it was important to get the specifics and really understand who Jeff is as a person even before the event. There's this idea I had, if all of his family and if Erin loved him for his legs, he'd be in big trouble, you know? So I think that idea was essential.
Jeff, you're nodding. I mean, having just gauze removed is...
It was horrible.
So we see the pain. We see the Jeff before, always late for work, for Erin, always running, actually. Then the Jeff after. You feel like a loser.
I sort of always kind of struggled with that my whole life, like with school and just kind of being frustrated with what I want to do in my life. And especially when I lost my legs, I was like, I was lost. You saw me a couple times mm-hmm. throughout that journey and I was doing okay, but I was still inside. I was lost.
And then suddenly, to other people, you're a hero and you're not feeling that way.
I just dislike when people say that because there's so many other heroes that deserve recognition and I think. Definitely. You can see it in the movie.
Well, Jake, it's clearly in the movie. Jeff's mom has arranged for Oprah to come. You know, Jeff doesn't want Oprah to come. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that maybe you as an actor identify with a little bit of what was happening to Jeff. You know, people make actors symbols
right.
and assign you things that you think don't belong.
I think there is a certain type of attention, and I think a certain you're in a way forced to perform. You know, sometimes perform yourself and the idea people have of you, particularly for someone like Jeff and the character I play of Jeff in the movie, where not only you're trying to recalibrate your life without two legs, you know, recalibrating your nervous system to try and figure out how to walk in these geniums and all of those things.
You gestured at the legs that he has on right now.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden people are giving you a whole new identity. You know, there's a line in the movie, and I think Jeff said it often, I was just standing there, you know, and now all of a sudden I'm like someone's deeming me a hero. And I think actually there are two reasons why people feel that way. One is because, you know, you did play a large role in identifying the bomber. But I think essentially the idea of being a symbol for people is something that I can see Jeff having grown into. I see him really donning that, okay, I understand what I mean to people.
Right. And talk about the role Carlos played in that. Carlos Arredondo, the man in the cowboy hat, when his son was killed in war and the Marines came to tell him, he tried to kill himself, Carlos did. His remaining son did kill himself because of the strain of losing. And Carlos, we'd see him around here in Boston driving around his pickup truck with all the flags, you know, trying
to. You can't miss him.
And there he is on that day. And when we spoke to him, you know, the day after the bombing, we said, you know, you saved a life, but it saved your life, you know, because Carlos was on the brink of suicide. And in the film, we see it was a long time before you met with Carlos. We now see you together all the time, but when he told you his story, that seemed to change things for you.
When I first heard about Carlos's story, I was really thrown back because I asked, you know, I'm like, why was he there? And someone explained he was handing out American flags to the ruckpack soldiers that were rucking the marathon. And I don't believe in many things or like coincidences, but, you know, it's almost like a coincidence that we met.
Yeah. But did he also seem to tell you that it was okay to be a symbol for people and to now reach out to people?
Yeah, he showed me that. Every time I kind of want to isolate, he's there and he's always trying to pull me out. And he's like, come on. That's just how he is. And he's just, he is definitely a role model in my life right now. And He's a very strong person. He's also worked hard on himself, too, so I could see that. I knew where he was.
Right. Jake, you are playing Jeff when people are starting to come up to him in almost a pilgrimage way. Mm-hmm. In this scene at Fenway Park, after Jeff throws out a pitch, it's a young man whose brother was killed by an IED in Afghanistan. Let's listen.
You showed the world that they can't break us no matter what the hell they do. You know, it gave me a little hope, made me feel a little better, and I just want to thank you for that, man. That's all.
What's your name?
My name's Larry.
Can I shake your hand, Larry?
You want to shake my hand?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to be okay, right? So you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that like to embody that part of Jeff's story?
It's uncomfortable, but I would say that he's uncomfortable with those moments. You know, he says in the movie, and Jeff says this, I hear him say it often in life, he says, if I'm going to be okay, you're going to be okay.
And it's like, if Carlos can be okay, you're going to be okay, Jeff.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Like a chain. We see you in the defining iconic moments where you're brought out on the ice in a wheelchair at the Bruins game. You're brought out at a Red Sox game. You gave this incredible, hopeful image to people. But now we now see how tough that was for you. It seems like you were almost having PTSD flashbacks in those moments, that huge noise. That was hard for you.
Yeah, really hard. It was my biggest fear going into those events. It's like, what am I going to do in these huge crowds? Like, then I got talking about it with public speaking and really telling my story, and that really helped. Mm. I could sleep at night a little better, and as I carried on, it got better.
The other day, we were at the Toronto Film Festival where the movie premiered, and there were about 2,800 people in this theater watching the movie for the first time, and Jeff and I watched it together for the first time. And at the end of the movie, the spotlight came up on Jeff, and he was like, what do I do? And I was like, get up. And he got up, and as he got up, all 2,800 people stood up as well. And it was in that moment where I realized what the movie was about, was letting people know what a journey it had been to get him to just stand up.
Hmm. Erin.
E.
Who is heroic in this film? Yeah. She sticks by you. It gets messy. You know, she's having to clean up after you, carry you up and downstairs. Your lives eventually get much better when some of the funds come in from the relief fund. You moved into a beautiful home. This isn't in the film, but we know this in real life. Have your beautiful daughter.
We moved out of my mom's apartment.
Moved out of the walk-up. Yeah. But what's not in the movie, you guys parted a little while ago.
I mean, you could see it in the movie. You could see it at the end. I say I love you, and she says good. And I'm a person. I make mistakes. But relationships are hard, and they're really hard. And I'm trying to really right now work on myself. You know, it wasn't like that for the past 3 years. It was like a whirlwind, and it still is a whirlwind. And I had so much going on with my daughter, with my recovery, and I still do. So it's right now. I see her all the time, every day almost, because of Nora. It's mainly about our daughter.
Well, the film becomes a legacy to that. You see the two of you, two people, put in this unimaginable place with such deep love and hard work, you know, getting through.
What you can see and what gets me every time is the love and her by my side in the hospital and how she was and how she was my hero.
Well, and it sounds, Jeff, like it sounds like it's a good thing that you maybe have some time to yourself to keep working on this. People think, oh, it's over. You made a movie, you wrote a book. How great. But no. So
my journey is just starting, especially, you know, I'm walking better every month.
Upstairs, downstairs, Jake, all day long.
He likes to make fun of me. He's like, yeah, a year ago, you remember you would be sucking wind up these stairs.
Well, Jeff Bowman, his story is told in the new film Stronger. He's played by Jake Gyllenhaal. Can't say enough about it. Opens Friday. Jeff, Jake, thanks so much.
Robin, you're the best.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Some thoughts. Every caregiver in the film is Jeff's real caregiver. His family really does have those great Boston accents. And Roadside Attractions, which produced the film, underwrites this program.
The S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average opened at record highs this morning, continuing their upward movement ahead of a key meeting tomorrow at the Federal Reserve. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And what's expected from the Fed?
Not a lot, I have to say. This is going to be one of those snoozer of a meetings, because really what we know is that the economy is growing, but it's not growing very quickly. We also know that inflation remains tame. And put on top of that, these two storms, which definitely will shave some growth, the pace of growth down for the third quarter. And I think that means the central bank's going to sit tight, 1 to 1.25%. That's where short-term interest rates are right now. And I think that for most investors, they believe the Fed could be done for the entire year. And that's a surprise. I think a lot of people thought we'd get one more rate increase before the end of 2017.
Well, is that what's driving the market higher, is people think the Fed won't be raising interest rates so quickly?
Well, I think that if you look at the combination of low interest rates and then you see quarterly profits of companies in the S&P 500, really a bit stronger than most had expected, and essentially not a lot happening even on the fiscal side. We're not counting on tax changes right this second, but maybe they'll get something. I think that that's a sign to investors that the status quo is where we are. We do see stock valuations a little bit richer, but I can't say there's a ton of folks who are saying that things are so overblown that a crash is coming. Of course, that's when a crash usually comes.
Exactly. We also may hear from the Fed in the next couple of days about how they're going to unwind their $4.5 trillion portfolio. They bought a lot of bonds during the financial crisis.
Yeah, I think that's something that investors are prepared for. Janet Yellen and other Fed officials have been talking about this. Is called balance sheet normalization, which is how you can sound so cool at your October parties that are going to be coming up. And what it really means is the Fed bought all of these bonds to help boost the economy, as you said, during the financial crisis, during the recession, and during the recovery period. Now all these bonds have to come off. Now, the first thing they're going to do is they say, oh, we're not reinvesting the interest. And then slowly but surely, they're going to start pulling those bonds down. It's not going to be something that's crazy and quick. I think the market is sort of saying, look, Janet Yellen is a dove. That means she tends to do things pretty slowly. She doesn't want to upend the status quo. That's probably good for markets. Another reason why people believe that the stock market is the place to be right now.
One of the things that has moved the stock market and has led to a couple of big drops in the Dow over the last few months has been worries about North Korea. Now, President Trump is going to make an address at the UN tomorrow. Is that likely to rattle the markets in any way?
You know, the president always has a shot at rattling everyone, including the markets. And I think that depending on the rhetoric, we're going to see some action. Now, listen, it's really important to remember that when you look at the Federal Reserve's point of view, when you look at the investor point of view, it's through a lens of understanding that not everything said by the president is what is actually going to happen. So the most important thing that I can say is regardless of what occurs in the next few days, whether it's the Fed, the president, or geopolitical tensions in some other area of the world, please don't abandon your financial game plan. Stick to it. Don't go crazy here.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
Hurricane Maria could make landfall later this week on St. Thomas, St. John, St. Martin, Caribbean islands already devastated by Irma. So what happens to tourism? On the U.S. Virgin Islands alone, about half of the 100,000 residents work in tourism. Hugh Riley is Secretary General of the Caribbean Tourism Organization. We last spoke as he arrived on Antigua as part of an emergency response team after Irma. He's back in Barbados. Hugh, on some of the islands, not a building, tree, or road is undamaged. Your sense of how this will impact tourism?
Well, it will. I mean, tourism is our livelihood in the Caribbean, and every country that you have just mentioned, every island that you have mentioned, depends upon tourism to a greater or lesser extent, more to a greater extent. And so the rebuilding process will take a while, and until that happens, there is going to be some pain. Most of the Caribbean is untouched by Irma, but the entire Caribbean is still going to be affected. Earlier in the year, our forecast was to receive 30 million visitors to the Caribbean this year. Mm. Irma has changed that forecast. All things are not equal anymore. We've had a Category 5 hurricane come through that's damaged a number of our islands and has endangered, to some extent, even those that are untouched, unscathed by Irma.
How so?
Well, people don't always have a good, sharp sense of the geography of the Caribbean. I mean, Bahamas is a good example where the islands of the Bahamas cover an area of 100,000 square miles. Some things that happen in the southern part of the Bahamas might have nothing at all to do with Nassau. But people don't have a good sense of that. So Hurricane Irma, as devastating as it has been in a few islands, left many islands untouched because it didn't go anywhere near most of the islands.
Right, and so you're afraid that people will just in general say, I'm afraid of going to the Caribbean.
That's exactly the problem that we have.
Well, tell us some of the islands that weren't touched.
Barbados, St. Lucia, and Grenada, and Trinidad and Tobago, and I mean, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Dominica, Martinique and Guadeloupe. These are all islands that are very, very popular and very well known. St. Kitts and Nevis. People should really do two things. Look at a map of the Caribbean or just simply take a look at the official website of the island that you're thinking about.
Yeah. I'm looking at a map right now. It's a reminder of just how many beautiful islands there are. But what are your fears? I mean, St. Martin, flattened. You know, what happens to those people when they can't work? And maybe it's St. Bart's, right, you know, next door, they can. I mean, along those lines, maybe people migrating, leaving.
Well, there is always going to be some displacement, and there are ways of handling that. Let's look at what's happened in terms of the islands that are associated with a developed country. So the French government has already stepped up and offered all kinds of assistance, as you might imagine, to rebuild and replace and accommodate the French territories. Similar sentiments have come from the United States government in regard to U.S. territories, particularly the U.S. Virgin Islands, which has taken it on the chin.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Dutch government and with the British government. So the question is, where do displaced people go? How do they get accommodated? Where do they find work? That's going to happen via the means that I've just mentioned, but it will also happen within the Caribbean. Already you're going to see the movement of skilled labor around the Caribbean because people are able to do that within certain parameters in the region.
We spoke to you, as we said, a week ago. What islands have you since visited, and what did you see?
my group went to Anguilla, and some went to the British Virgin Islands. So I was able to see firsthand the kinds of issues, some of which are not immediately obvious. So if your electricity supply isn't strong or doesn't exist in some parts of the island, it certainly affects your ability to do banking. Well, if your banking isn't really functioning, that affects people's ability to pay. Most people don't walk around with pockets full of cash. They have credit cards. But if you're trying to do business and pay with your credit card, but the banking system isn't up and running or the connectivity via telecoms isn't there, then you can't get credit card approval. So the obvious answer is, well, why don't you pay cash? Oops. But you can't go to the ATM to get cash. Everything is contingent upon something else being up and running. Similarly, there are a number of businesses in Anguilla, and I'm sure throughout the other affected territories of the Caribbean, where the electrical supply was knocked out, then there's a generator. So big hotels have powerful generators, but those generators need fuel. And the fuel supply, I mean, you can expect long lines waiting at petrol stations trying to get fuel. And then somebody said, well, don't worry about it because a tanker is going to arrive tomorrow. Fine. Now, a Category 5 hurricane churns up the waves quite a bit and could disturb those underwater lines from which the fuel would come from the tanker to the storage units. Mm. So those have to be inspected before you can get your new supplies of fuel.
Well, look, we've been reading, you know, comments from some of the country's ministers for tourism. I'm looking at Asat Michael, I think it is, from Antigua. He says a week lost in tourism arrivals in Antigua is worth about $5 million in expenditure in our economy. Is there a push to maybe ask tourists to come, even though the islands aren't ready, maybe create a sort of help us rebuild tourism?
Well, people are actually volunteering to do that. Two things are happening. There is already a groundswell of what people call voluntourism, sort of people saying, I want to come, yeah. I want to help in some way, I want to start with the rebuilding process. And then there are others saying, look, I know that the best way of helping is to come there and be a tourist.
Hugh Riley, Secretary General of the Caribbean Tourism Organization, the development agency representing all 28 Caribbean countries. Hugh, best to you in the coming months.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your concern. Thank you, Robin.
Well, nearly 18 million cruise ship passengers visited St. Thomas and St. John alone last year, but now ports on the Dutch side of St. Martin, on St. Thomas and Tortola, are closed indefinitely. Three of the busiest cruise ports in the world, Miami, Port Everglades, and Port Canaveral, were also briefly closed. Andrew Coggins is a cruise analyst and management professor at Pace University's Lubin School of Business. Professor, what did Irma do to the industry?
Well, they have to cancel a number of cruises and terminate a number of cruises earlier, so they will end up compensating the guests. So normally they give them a credit towards a future cruise.
Yeah. Well, and Port Key West was another one that is closed indefinitely, as are the ones in, as we said, the Caribbean. What does that do? I mean, they're talking about weeks to months to bring this up.
Well, what will happen is the islands will let the cruise lines know when they're able to take cruise ships. And then the cruise ships will start sending the ships in, because that will start bringing in money from outside, probably faster than the hotels can come back online.
Yeah, it can bring people more. But the thing about a cruise ship is you want to disembark and go buy things. And if there's nothing to see, I mean, you know, you're saying it'll bring people in before hotels, which will have a harder time coming back. But will people want to go?
Well, the cruise lines will manage it so that there'll be something there for people to see and do when they go in there.
Yeah.
It won't be exactly what it was before.
Look, Norwegian Cruise Line says they're replacing all Eastern Caribbean itineraries at least through November, a couple months there. What are those stops?
The Eastern Caribbean would be San Juan, St. Thomas, St. Martin, St. Martin, Barbuda, Anguilla, and Antigua. They're reachable on a one-week cruise from Florida, several ports in 1 week.
We talked about the ships that were offering relief, which is just great. But do you have it? Has anybody come up with numbers yet, trying to figure out how much of a hit might the industry take?
No, that hasn't been determined yet. Once they have an idea of the full extent of the damage, which is still in the process of being assessed, and what a recovery schedule might look like, then they'd be able to say what the impact on the industry's earnings would be.
Yeah.
The industry on a whole is doing quite well. I think this year they're going to carry over 24 million passengers worldwide. And it's growing by leaps and bounds in Asia, especially the Chinese outbound market. However, the Caribbean is the largest area, but all the Caribbean hasn't been affected by the storm.
Okay. That's Andrew Coggins, cruise analyst and management professor at Pace University's Lubin School of Business. Professor Andrew, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
4 decades ago, the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins published a book that changed science. In his book, The Selfish Gene, Dawkins argued that genes competing for survival not only drive evolution, but also animal and human behavior. It was an abstract idea at first, but now scientists, including researchers at the Stowers Institute in Kansas City, are figuring out how selfish genes actually do their work. Alex Smith from KCUR reports.
In the cooler section of any Whole Foods, you can find kombucha, the yeast-fermented tea sold with some pretty over-the-top marketing claims.
The mission of Unity Vibration Kombucha is to spread love, health, and possibility into the world and to better the lives of millions with our products.
That's a video promoting kombucha's peace and love image. But researchers at the Stowers Institute, a biomedical research organization in Kansas City, have discovered some downright sinister activity during the mating of a yeast cell that's found in kombucha. Stowers investigator Sarah Zanders says she started working with Schizosaccharomyces kombucha yeast while working in Seattle, although she's never been a fan of the tea itself.
I'm very thankful for the tea because it's given me a career, but I don't myself drink it.
Normally during mating, whether we're talking about yeast, mice, or humans, there's a kind of showdown between the parties involved to decide which genes get passed along to the next generation and which don't. But S. kombucha sometimes contains a selfish gene called WTF4, which hijacks the reproduction process using a particularly malicious maneuver. WTF4 genes pass along to their offspring a poison designed to kill them.
What we've likened it to is like an Agatha Christie-type murder scenario.
Or maybe the 1987 movie, The Princess Bride. When a cell with the WTF4 gene mates with a cell that doesn't have it, the resulting genetic battle is not unlike the scene in the movie where Wesley, the ninja-like hero played by Cary Elwes, faces off against Vizzini, the wannabe criminal mastermind played by Wallace Shawn.
So, it is down to you, and it is down to me.
Wesley takes 2 cups of wine and tells Vizzini he secretly dosed one with a poison called iocane powder. He sets both cups on a table and lets Vizzini choose who will drink from which one. After a few minutes of verbal gymnastics and a sly switcheroo, Vizzini grabs a cup, gulps it down, and, spoiler alert, drops dead. Princess Buttercup, whom Wesley has come to rescue and is played by Robin Wright, then says,
"To think, all that time it was your cup that was poisoned."
Wesley explains his secret.
"They were both poisoned. I spent the last few years building up an immunity to iocane powder."
The WTF4 gene has a similar trick up its sleeve. When it reproduces, it poisons all of its offspring. But to the offspring lucky enough to inherit the WTF4 gene, it also passes along the ability to create an antidote to save itself. By doing this, the gene basically rigs the game to preserve its continued existence generation after generation. University of Maryland biology professor Gerald Wilkinson explains that Zander's research opens a rare window on what's happening inside selfish genes.
The actual genetic details of how they work has only been figured out for a handful of cases. So it's really probably less than 6 cases that we understand well.
Selfish genes are found throughout nature and have a lot of different ways to rig the genetic game. There are even some that use a poison and antidote technique similar to the WTF4. But typically, they work in teams, with one gene creating the poison while another creates the antidote. Wilkinson says that Zander's research is remarkable because it shows, for the first time, one gene that can do both.
The single gene carries both the poison and the antidote. And the fact that that even exists opens up the possibility that that kind of genetic element might be found elsewhere.
Selfish genes like the WTF4 might seem like a good thing for an organism hoping to pass along its DNA, but their selfishness doesn't necessarily pay off for the organism in the long run. That's because while selfish genes hijack the genetic lottery in their favor, they also muck with natural selection.
Genes are stuck to each other end to end, and they kind of are inherited in groups. And what can happen is that if junk accumulates next to a selfish gene, it is transmitted along with the selfish gene.
Researchers think this junk might include genetic predispositions to certain diseases that would normally get weeded out over the generations, but instead get passed along thanks to the shield of protection provided by neighboring selfish genes. Some scientists are now working to borrow selfish techniques and use them in engineering DNA in hopes they can steer evolution to reduce populations of, say, mosquitoes carrying Zika or other pests that we'd like to do without. Zander says the first step is understanding how to cheat the evolutionary process.
Like human society, there's a million different ways to cheat to get ahead, and we're just starting to appreciate some of the strategies that selfish genes are employing to do that.
And by learning how to be genetically selfish, researchers may give humans a competitive edge to help us stay healthy. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Smith in Kansas City.
And listeners in Kansas City of KCUR, we're going to be visiting next month. Send us your story ideas on Twitter at Here and Now. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.